House Community and Regional Affairs Committee meeting to order. Today is Tuesday, February 24th, and the time is 8:05 a.m. Thank you for waiting for me. Members present are everyone. Representative Kai Holland, Representative Mike Prox, Representative Garrett Nelson, Representative Steve St. Clair, Representative Carolyn Hall, Co-Chair Rebecca Hemshute, and myself, Co-Chair Donna Mears. We have a quorum to conduct business. Just a reminder for everyone, first thing in the morning, to silence your cell phones. If you need to pass a note to committee members, please get the attention of my aide, Talia Ames. Thank you, Talia. And thanks to Co-Chair Hemshute's committee aide, Thatcher Brower. Before we get started, I'd also like to thank our recording secretary, Sophia Tenney, and helping us from the Juno LIO is Jude Augustine. We have three bills on our agenda today. First, we will hold the bill introduction invited testimony for HB 155, Alcohol Sales Local Option, sponsored by Representative Foster. Next, we'll hold the bill introduction and invited and public testimony for committee bill, HB 329, Electric Utility Certificate of Fitness. And last, we will hear bill introduction and invited testimony for HB 291, Municipal Property Tax Exemptions, sponsored by Representative Cologne. I'd also like to remind the committee we have a shorter hearing today to allow time for the DOC Finance Subcommittee, so we'll have a hard stop at 8:55 to transition committees. So, first we'll take up HB 155. Representative Foster is unable to make it this morning. A little busy up in finance, I assume. So, his Chief of Staff, Paula Bowl, is here. Welcome to the committee. Please put yourself on the record and share the bill with us.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. HB 155 creates a new local option for alcohol. For the people at home who may not know, Alaska has multiple ways of dealing with alcohol and its legality by community. And you can go from everything from wet, where no alcohol is allowed in town at all, to what we call, that would be dry, to wet, which is what you in an urban sector would expect, where bars, restaurants, and liquor stores are all run by private industry. One of the options in the middle that is current law allows municipalities to exclusively run the liquor license. However, that particular option requires that if you run one of those licenses, you have to run all those licenses. This creates a new local option where you can run the liquor store by the city while leaving the remaining restaurant and bar licenses to the private sector.
Thank you very much. Do we have any questions from the committee? Representative Hall.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. So is this essentially having an enhanced option in damp communities? Is that kind of what you're talking about? Or am I mistaken with what maybe damp means?
Yeah, thank you for the question. So technically speaking, damp is where sales are not allowed, but importation is allowed. This is kind of its own weird thing that it doesn't have a nickname like the other ones do.
Thank you.
Thank you. Do we have other questions from the committee? Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So could you give an example of, like, not a specific community, but one where, like, this would actually take place? So just going off of the wet, dry, damp, even though there's not a – I mean, would this be something that would be implemented in a community that's currently wet, you know, but somehow the municipality is precluded from running a separate store? Does that make sense?
Yeah, thank you for the question. I can actually name a community. Kotzebue, which is not in Rep. Foster's district, but the last time we presented the bill, the representative from there expressed interest in it because Kotzebue currently has a liquor store that is run by the municipality, but they wanted to open a bar and grill restaurant, but they were prohibited from doing so because it would have to be run by the city, and the city wasn't interested in running it, but they were interested in allowing it.
Follow up. So in that example, a private entity wanted to open a bar and restaurant but weren't allowed to because Kotzebue wasn't interested in running it. Did I understand what you said correctly?
You are correct, because that is the current law. Because the municipality owns the package store license, they would have to also own the restaurant license.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. St. Clair. Representative St. Clair.
Through the chair, how many communities, I know Nome's probably one of them too, which is in your boss's district. Do we have an estimate on how many communities this would affect or would benefit from this?
I would have to think about that. So in terms of the number of communities that currently hold licenses for alcohol sales, be it restaurant, bar, or package store, that would be a question for the department. Nome actually is a wet community. It's all done privately. Any community could opt for this local option. So in terms of who it could affect, it could be anyone. Juneau could decide it wants to do that. But it would be an election held in each community, and so it's up to them to decide.
Thank you.
Thank you. I'd also like to note that we do have Kevin Richard on the phone. He is the director for the Alcohol and Marijuana Control Office. So if there are any questions, he's available for some technical support as well. Representative Holland.
Great. Thank you. And through the chair, I'm kind of getting my head around why this limit exists to begin with. It seems like it's created a barrier to private business in these communities, but perhaps there was a good reason that it was done this way. Do you have some background on why we created this original structure that caused us to have, if there was the local community running the liquor license that it was blocking at, was there a benefit? Was there a reason that somebody said this was the right way to do it in order to control what was going on in the community and the distribution of alcohol? And has something changed that now we need to look at it differently? What do you have any history or background that helps me understand why this even got to this point, why we have to unwind it?
Thank you for the question. I don't have the history of the creation of the local option laws. All this was it was brought to us by a constituent in the city of Nome who would like Nome to be able to do this but can't do it. And we looked it over. We checked it out with Ledge Legal, and there were no problems with it. So we decided to move forward.
Follow up.
Thank you, Representative Holland. Follow
Great.
Up.
Thank you. And just following up with that then, assuming this were to be enacted, what's next? Are there still existing limits and controls that the local community would have in terms of who gets to apply and how many new licenses are now available for somebody applying for? Would this unleash an unintended consequence of a large number of alcohol license requests? And are the communities structured to be able to handle that? I'm not sure what the implication would be if this passed and how the communities would be asked to support what I observe in Anchorage is a fairly complex process of people applying for licenses and community councils looking at it and the assembly looking at it and AMCO and whatnot. So what would be the consequence if this were to be enacted?
Thank you for the question. So in the first place, the number of licenses per community would still be controlled by the population limits that are in statute. Okay. So that would not change. And then in terms of the process, the city council would have to hold a special election to put the local option before the voters, and the voters would have to vote for it.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Hemshire.
Thanks, through the chair. I just was hoping we could go to the person at the department to see if they can fill in the gaps about – I have a few communities where the alcohol license is operated by the community, And the history of that has been explained to me in the community, but I wouldn't mind if the department person is able to provide context.
Mr. Richard, you have some history lesson for us today on local options. Mr. Richard, if you're speaking, we can't hear you. Are you on?
Through the chair, this is Kevin Richard with the Alcohol and Marijuana Control Office. I can hear you. Yes, I wasn't clear of what the question was.
Thank you. The committee was hoping to get a little background on why the current policy exists for if you've got one, you got both for either private or city run.
Through the chair, for the record, this is Kevin Richard with the Alcohol Marijuana Control Office. I don't have that history readily available in front of me, but it is definitely something I can investigate and prepare a memo for the committee.
Yes, Mr. Richard, it would be helpful to have a little background on that for the committee. Do we have any other further questions from the committee at this time? Seeing and hearing none, thank you very much, Mr. Richard. Thank you very much, Mr. LeBoll. So with that, we will set the bill aside until a later date and take a brief at ease to hand over the gavel to co-chair Hemshoot. So present the next bill on behalf of the committee.
We are back on record. Next, we're going to hear Committee Bill House Bill 329, an act relating to certificates of fitness for employees of an electric utility. Co-Chair Mears and her staff, Griffin Plush, could you please put yourselves on the record and proceed with the bill introduction?
Thank you. Representative Donna Mears from House District 21, South Muldoon in East Anchorage.
Griffin Plush, staff to Representative Mears.
Good morning, members of the House Community and Regional Affairs Committee. HB 329 seeks to clarify statute in order to address a recent administrative decision to change the interpretation of the longstanding rural exemption of the Certificate of Fitness. AS 18.62.010 exempts workers doing electrical work for electric utilities in communities with a population under 2,500 from needing certificates of fitness. The Alaska Village Electric Cooperative, AVEC, serves 58 communities, and only one of those has a population of over 2,500, Bethel. AVEC took over as Bethel's electric utility in 2014, and since then they've utilized the exemption in the rest of their communities while keeping their certificate of fitness for workers in Bethel. Recently, the Department of Labor and Workforce Development informed AVEC that workers in all of their communities would be required to have certificates of fitness due to the inclusion of Bethel in their service area, bringing the population for the entire utility over 2,500. As you will hear from Bill Stamm at AVEC, this exemption has been critical to keep the lights on in remote Alaska communities, where it can be burdensome to employ certificated linemen for the performance of a simple upkeep. AVEC is beginning to grapple with the logistical costs and delays caused by the department's revocation of this exemption. It's important that we act quickly to prevent this revocation from worsening reliability and increasing costs for AVEC customers. We will now move on to our sectional from Mr. Plush.
Mr. Plush?
For the record, Griffin Plush. The Section 1 of this bill amends AS 18-62010. This changes This change clarifies a current exemption allowing employees of electric utilities that serve rural remote communities with a population under 2,500 to perform electrical work without a certificate of fitness. The clarification focuses on two criteria. First, it ensures that the existing exemption applies to portions of service areas that are not electrically interconnected and under 2,500 population. Second, it ensures that the exemption applies to municipal or tribal government employees working on behalf of the utility. Section 2 defines qualified employee, and this section adopts a definition based on Occupational Safety and Health Administration regulation for application of the term qualified employees in Section 1.
Okay, thank you for that. We're going to turn now to our invited testifiers, and given our timeline this morning, I'm going to ask folks to just hold your questions, I think, until we get through both of our invited folks, then we'll go back to questions for either of them if you have them. So our first invited testifier is Bill Stom, President and CEO, Alaska Village Electric Cooperative. Mr. Stom, please put yourself on the record and proceed with your testimony. Good morning. Welcome.
Good morning. Bill Stom, I have the pleasure of serving as President and CEO of Alaska Village Electric Cooperative. I'd like to thank co-chairs Mayor and Hemshute for picking up this issue and through the committee presenting it to the legislature. I guess just some background for those. I see a lot of familiar faces there, but for those that are not familiar with ABEC, we serve 58 rural communities throughout Alaska. They are primarily in western Alaska and northwest Alaska, but we also serve communities in southeast on Kodiak Island, St. Lawrence Island, Winnebago Island. So they're fairly well spread out. Very few of these communities are interconnected. Only one of them is accessible by road. So we have 46 individual power plants serving those 58 communities. As Representative Mears had mentioned, we picked up the Bethel Utility Corporation in 2014, and Bethel has a population of over 6,000 people. That is a different operating procedure. We have 10 full-time employees in Bethel. We have journeyman linemen on staff, and we do all our work in accordance with the requirements for certificates of fitness. In all of the other communities that we serve, we have had been operating since inception in 1968 under the exemption for communities less than 2,500 people, allowing us to work both with apprentice linemen and local power plant operators in order to do minor maintenance on our distribution systems. That was brought to an abrupt halt over the summer after getting a cease and desist order from the Department of Labor. And we did request a waiver or a variance from the Department of Labor, and they said it was beyond their authority. And the strict interpretation of the legislation, they would have to defer to a change in legislation before they would allow anything like that. So that is why the matter is before you at this time. And I guess I'd just like to thank Representative Mears and her office personnel for picking this up and getting in touch with the IBEW. I think working through some of the language and Ledge Legal, it is better than the original wording that I had proposed. So I appreciate all the efforts going forward, and I'll stand by for questions.
Great. Thank you very much. If you could stay on the line, Mr. Stam, we'll go to Ryan Andrew with the IBEW Local 1547. Mr. Andrew, if you could put yourself on record and proceed with your testimony. We're happy to hear from you this morning. Good morning.
Good morning, Madam Chair and the committee members. For the record, my name is Ryan Andrew, and I'm one of the assistant business managers for IBEW Local 1547 here in Alaska. IBEW represents thousands of electrical workers across the state, in both the construction industry as well as at small and large electrical utilities. IBEW members, we place a high value on professional licensing, and especially the electrical trade license known as the Certificate of Fitness here in Alaska. In our industry, the Certificate of Fitness requires that electricians and power linemen have had at least 8,000 hours of training in their field, and that they take a competency exam before they're able to work as journeymen and women. Electrical work, as you all know, is inherently hazardous, and the Certificate of Fitness here ensures that workers are qualified to be able to perform the work safely. requiring electricians and power linemen to hold the license results in safer workplace and a safer public in general. Because we feel so strongly about the certificate of fitness and of its importance to IBEW members here in Alaska, we really feel that any exception to its requirements should be narrow and should be well-defined. We believe that this is the case with HB 329. We'll say thank you to the committee members again for allowing the testimony, and appreciate it.
Thank you, Mr. Andrew. Are there questions from the committee for the bill sponsor or either of the invited testifiers? Representative Prox.
Yes, thank you. Through the chair, I guess to whomever, work just involve maintenance work, or does that include new construction?
Mr. Stamm.
Okay, let's go back to Bill Stamm with that question.
Okay.
Mr. Stamm, did you get the question?
Yes, I did. Thank you. Representative Prox through the chair. I guess conceivably, the way it's written, it would include both. As a practical matter, it is typically just maintenance of facilities that are existing.
And follow-up?
Follow-up.
Does AVAC, or does the bill then include some sort of training requirement? I appreciate what Mr. Andrew is talking about, inherent danger.
Let's go back to Mr. Stamm with that question, and then perhaps Mr. Andrew as well, just to make sure we're clear.
Yeah. Certainly there is inherent danger in working in and around electrical apparatus, energized lines. AVAC does have training regimes and works with our power plant operators to make sure that they are qualified to do the tasks that we ask them to do. As the electric utility, we are responsible for providing a safe workplace. Any of the folks that we ask to do work, we make sure that they have demonstrated the abilities that we've trained them on before we ask them to perform the work in the field. The requirements within this legislation, as listed, do highlight if we are using community members that are actually employees of the municipal government or tribe, that they are qualified to do the work they do, and that is using the term qualified as often used throughout the OSHA regulations for safe workplace.
Follow-up?
Continue, I guess, yes. But this, through the chair, this would be an internal. AVIC controls it as opposed to regulatory or somebody else controlling the qualifications.
So the qualification standards, Mr. Stamm, is that set by AVEC, or is there an entity setting the qualifications for your qualified workers?
Yeah, so the level of standard would be meeting the standards for OSHA. And we typically have a de-energized line work policy within AVEC, so in our smaller communities, we do not do hot work. We de-energize our lines, we test them, ground them before we do any work on the distribution, adding another level of safety. But there is quite a difference between the facilities that are installed throughout rural Alaska in these small isolated systems and what you might see out the window there in Juneau.
Right.
But regardless, electricity is not something to be dealt lightly with, and we do take all the care we believe is necessary in order to make sure that the folks that are working on these lines are safe.
Thank you.
Quick one.
Okay. Follow up, and then we'll go to Mr. Andrew as well.
Is there a maximum voltage involved with this? Like, do you generate 480 volt power or 240 volt power above 480 volt?
Mr. Stamm.
Yeah, so that was one of the discussion items when we were going through this with the IBEW, and they questioned whether we had transmission lines, which are higher voltage typically. ABEC generally generates at 480 volt three-phase. We still have some communities that are 120, 240 volt single-phase. We step that voltage up for distribution to 7,200 volts single-phase and 14,4 three-phase. But we do not have what is typically considered transmission voltage, which would be over 25 kV. We do have one or two distribution lines that go between communities that are energized at 25 kV, but nothing higher than that.
And I think just to be doubly sure, if we could check with Mr. Andrew on this line of questioning as well. Mr. Andrew, who sets the safety standards? And I guess for clarification, maybe before we leave, Mr. Stamm, so Bethel, for instance, would still require the certificate of fitness. That still applies there. It's in the smaller communities where this exemption would apply. Is that correct? Oh, you're
That's
mute.
Correct, and that exemption is already.
Okay, go ahead.
I'm sorry. Yes, that is correct. Bethel is a community with more than 2,500 people, so the exemption does not apply. The exemption that's on the books today applies to communities under 2,500, but only for utility employees that do not have within their service territory any community or, I think, a consolidated municipality, or there's some wording in there that says no part of your service area can have more than 2,500 folks. So that is what we've been trying to clarify, just making sure that the exemption would still apply even though we require the community of Bethel.
So this simply separates the two. And I think if it's okay, we'll go to Mr. Sure. Andrew as well with the question about training standards. Mr. Andrew, could you add anything to the conversation?
Thank you, Co-Chair Hemshute. I think what's already been said is accurate. I think that the certificate of fitness, as it's covered in statute, does require the standard of training, the 8,000 hours of training for each trade. And that competency exam that I mentioned earlier, I think with the exception that exists in statute already, the employer would be the one who is responsible for making sure that their employees are qualified if they're exempted from having the certificate of fitness in those small communities. I hope that's helpful.
But still within the standards of OSHA?
That's correct.
Okay. Great. Are there any other questions? Representative Hall?
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I'm curious, what are the barriers that are faced in communities to be able to get folks to have a certificate of fitness? Like, I imagine geography is a big part of it, but what are the other barriers?
So I think this question might go to Mr. Stamm. How do you get 8,000 hours in leave lock, Mr. Stamm?
So in these communities, that could be anywhere from 75 to, 2,500 people. There's not often folks that are interested in doing line work at all. Having one of those get all of the hours and certificates needed in order to become a journeyman lineman typically would require working outside their community for a number of years and traveling. We have had plant operators that have graduated into larger roles and working as a traveling technician for ABEC. Some of them have become linemen. Oftentimes they work for other utilities at a higher rate where they can go home at night. So there's a difficulty in identifying people from the outset, and then if you do get them through a certificated program and they do become or have a certificate of fitness, oftentimes we find that they end up working somewhere else.
Follow-up? No follow-up. Okay. Thank you. Representative St. Clair?
Just more of a comment. Madam Chair, could we get Department of Labor and Workforce Development in here to testify to give us some more information on this? And I know we're short on time, so I'm just going to keep it to that comment versus a question. I'm
wondering if you could take your question to the department offline. And
okay.
Yeah, I think that's a good path. Representative Holland.
Great. Thank you, through the chair. I'm just curious if there's some history behind why 2,500 was set as a criteria here. I assume that this entire situation is because we're trying to protect the safety and reliability of the operations or the safety of the people that are doing this work. So I'm kind of curious, where did 2,500 come from? And have there been any safety reliability issues that have been associated with not using somebody with a certificate of fitness that would tell us that that there's something to be
Mr. Stamm?
Careful about?
I did do some research and asked my legal counsel to do some research on the original exemption, and they were not able to turn up much. I was hopeful after receiving the notification from the Department of Labor, I could point towards some of the initiating legislation and say this is what the intent was, but I came up empty, so I can't provide any guidance as to what the original intent was. And to my knowledge, I have not. I mean, there has certainly, I can't say we have a clean record over the last 55 years, and nobody has ever gotten hurt. But I don't think that this has provided any greater harm to the folks that are working for AVEC in and around our electric utility.
Thank you.
Okay. And maybe last question to Mr. Representative Nelson.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I was curious if, I don't know who this would go to, but just examples of work that has been done in the past that now is essentially precluded, and what challenges those communities are seeing now, if that makes sense, you know, seeking this exemption. That makes sense. I don't know who it would go to.
Thank you. Mr. Stamm.
Mr. Stamm.
Thank you, through the chair. So I guess just there's a number of things that we ask our local operators to do. They might check a person's electrical service if they're complaining of power problems. They might drop a service line and reconnect the crimps at the top of the weatherhead. They might operate with a hot stick. I'm getting into some line language here that might not be understandable, but within the distribution system, there may be fused links within the system that are specifically designed to drop out when there's an overload or a line slap or some sort of issue. Icing, high winds can cause different parts of the distribution system to overload, and there would be this fuse that would drop out and isolate that section of the distribution system. As the law stands presently, I would have to ask a journeyman lineman, wherever they might be. They might be working in Russian Mission, and I would tell them to shut down their job, and they would have to fly to Teller in order to replace this cutout, which is something that a plant operator could be sufficiently trained to use the proper safety gear and do within an hour. I would have to probably wait a day before I could restore power to that section of town. And if the weather's poor, it may be multiple days. And not only creates longer outages for the folks that are waiting for power to be restored, which could be at temperatures well below zero, it also creates difficulties for the linemen that are working at one job to have to be interrupted continuously in order to fly around the state in order to take care of minor maintenance issues.
And the chartered flight comes at an expense to ratepayers.
Yes. One quick follow-up.
Follow-up.
So we have just to clarify, so there's a certificate of fitness, but even if you get an exemption from that, everybody who is operating in these jobs, that, like the example you just gave, you still adhere to OSHA standards.
Mr. Stamm, can you confirm your compliance with
OSHA?
That
is correct.
Okay, seeing no further questions from the committee, I'm going to open public testimony. And I'm looking first to people in the room. Don't see anyone in the room. Looking online. With nobody online, I'm going to close public testimony. And with that, we're going to set I guess I should remind folks, if there is somebody wanting to provide testimony, you can email. I am not going to do the house.community. No, we're not doing that. We're going to go with the short email. HCRA stands for House Community and Regional Affairs. So the email is hcra@akleg.gov for anyone wishing to send us their thoughts. I want to thank Co-Chair Mears and Griffin Plush for their time and for bringing this bill to us. And we were going to set an amendment deadline for House Bill 329 for Monday, March 2nd at noon. And then we will set the bill aside for today. Thanks for your time today, Mr. Stamm and Mr. Andrew. And we are going to take an at ease to transition back to Co-Chair Mears. At ease.
We are back on the record. Next, we will hear House Bill 291. Representative Colomb and Ms. Emily Durfee, welcome to the committee. Please put yourself on record and introduce your bill.
For the record, I'm Julie Colomb. I represent South Anchorage Hillside, District 11.
For the record, Emily Durfee, staff to Representative Colomb.
Thank you for hearing the bill today, committee and co-chairs. So HB 291 is about local control. This is a pretty simple bill. It repeals a lot of statutes that tell municipalities what they can and cannot exempt and their property exemptions. So there are optional exemptions. There's at the end of the bill, you'll see all the statutes relating to that. And the origin of this actually came a couple years ago when a bill came up that Senator Bjorkman was trying to pass to exempt farm structures in his district. And I thought, that's so strange that you have to bring a bill up to try to exempt farm structures. And so when I looked into it further, I saw that there was a lot of statute regarding property exemptions. And so when I looked into it, I thought, well, it's interesting that, you know, a municipality would have to write a bill, go through the process, get it passed, get it signed to exempt properties in their own district. And so the intent of the bill is just to remove that barrier at having to get permission from the state, and municipalities would just decide for themselves what they would exempt in their district. So we all know that everybody has a very different area. We know our own districts very well, and I think it's just the way that the state kind of grew up, where the state's giving permission for certain things. This would remove that. For a lot of the municipalities and mayors that I've talked to, this has been a priority for a while, that they didn't like this process and that they would have to go run a bill to do property tax exemptions. And so this only touches on the optional exemptions. There is another part of statute that has mandatory exemptions. That's kind of a different situation. This does not repeal any property exemptions that are in place right now. The statutes that I'm repealing all started with a municipality may, and then they would list out exactly what they could exempt. So it's not taking anything away from what's there now, because municipalities would have to, they would have had to adopt it in their own ordinances for it to happen. And so this just removes that permission part from the state to give ultimate local control. And if the chair would like, my staff could go through the sectional.
Thank you, Representative Coulomb. I think let's skip the sectional for now. I would, just for the committee's awareness, I'd like to have a larger discussion about this, and we're just doing bill introduction today. Mm-hmm. Since we've only got about 10 minutes left, I'd like Mr. Andreasen to provide his invited testimony. And then seeing where we've got questions, we do have a couple other folks online as well. And then Ms. Durfee, next time. We can go through the sectional. I know you're probably ready for it. I'd like to invite Mr. Andreasen up for our invited testimony. And then just for folks' awareness, if you're formulating questions on the line, we've got Sandra Moeller, who's the Director of Division of Community and Regional Affairs, as well as Dan Nelson, who is the State Assessor with DCCED. Mr. Andreasen, welcome back to CNRA. Please put yourself on the record and share with us your thoughts on optional property tax exemptions.
Okay, I was just here recently. Thank you for the record. Nils Andreasen, I'm the Executive Director of the Alaska Municipal League. Certainly appreciate the intent behind this bill. Local decision-making is something that AML has as a core principle. And this bill unwinds a lot of the restrictions around exemptions that could occur at the local level made by local decision makers. So I think I've got some broad comments, and then maybe to give you some thoughts about how to have a fuller conversation about this in the future. But clearly we've got, so maybe step back entirely, you've got two types of local governments in Alaska. You've got home rule and general law. So for general law, they can only do what you say they can do, which is why there are currently these optional exemptions in law. They couldn't adopt optional exemptions without them being allowed in law. Home rule could have. So really part of why this statute existed was to allow second-class cities and boroughs the ability to adopt exemptions. That's where kind of this micromanaged approach comes from. So this bill gives local governments more flexibility. Fewer one-size-fits-all categories. There's a principle, I think, within this bill of the voters decide when it comes to a certain dollar amount. And there's the potential to reduce legal complexity. So instead of trying to fit an exemption within what is in statute, there's the ability to really fine-tune it at the local level. At the same time, there's ways I think we could strengthen this this approach and fit, I think, constructively fit some additional nuance to make implementation smoother at the local level. There's kind of some risk of unintended consequences that we want to be careful of. So first, when we think about this $75,000, we have to think about where it came from. Is it the right number? Is it the right number for every community? Is it the right number for every classification or category of exemption? Or, for instance, there's an economic development exemption currently that could be property by property. And would that trigger for every single one of those exemptions a vote of the people? So is it by category? Is it by project? Thinking through how you want to approach those exemptions and avoid voter fatigue is probably something that you want to think about. You could have as many as, you could have 10 or 20 exemptions on a ballot, and that can get unworkable pretty quickly at the local level. So you want to think through, what are we trying to achieve when it comes to that $75,000 figure and a voter's decision-making? There are other ways to address that. You could think about a percent of value trigger to adjust it for high value and low value markets. You could think about a revenue impact trigger. To what extent does this affect local government's revenue? Is it affect a mill rate? And is it the mill rate that's the trigger? Or is it a loss of other services that's the trigger for voter decision making? I think it's important to think too broadly from a policy perspective, and then, you know, for voters, what's the cumulative impact? So it's not just this exemption, but it's this exemption on top of that exemption and the other exemption. And ultimately, what effect do all the exemptions have on the tax base and on the services that local governments are planning on delivering to voters? So that's what you want, I think, voters and taxpayers to wrestle with. One of the other things that I think we want to be really clear about, either in law or along the way, is what happens to existing exemptions. So yes, local governments would have adopted on their own these exemptions, but if they're pointing back to statute and the statute's no longer there, then you want to fix that. So think about, is there a grandfathered in or savings clause that you would want to add? Is there a phase out option for current exemptions at the local level that would allow them to sunset, for instance, over a certain number of years? Is this something, is the repeal of all of these exemptions something that you want to sunset and maybe revisit in 5 years or something like? So thinking about, so you've got chances to evaluate along the way. You also want to make sure that there's a hold harmless for current beneficiaries, those that you had intended in prior law prior to repealing to ensure there's benefit. And ultimately, if exemptions were to go away, you want to avoid tax shock administrative issues or a disproportionate burden that might be faced by fixed-income households. There are other guideposts, I think, that you might want to consider as part of your deliberations, and I'm happy to come back and kind of talk through any of these. But what would a fiscal impact statement look like at the local level that would evaluate the current exemption mix and how additional exemptions might affect that tax base or the services being provided? So it could include exempted assessed value, projected revenue loss, and the mill rate impact. Think about that sunset and the review requirement so that you're still doing due diligence at the state level to evaluate that general law versus home rule kind of discussion, but you've got some tools in place to allow you to make sure that it's having the desired effect. Make sure there's maybe uniform definitions and eligibility standards so that even as you allow for local autonomy across the state, you also find some consistency across jurisdictions so that businesses have a level playing field in how they operate. So making sure there's some consistency across jurisdictions might be helpful. Think about non-discrimination and uniformity principle and how exemptions are being applied. Think about, is there a cap on aggregate exemption impact? And I know, you know, especially maybe for the state assessor, that might be important when you're thinking about the full value determination and the required local contribution. The optional exemptions don't affect the full value determination in a way that mandatory exemptions do. So all of the optional exemptions that are out there still have to be made up for across the rest of your tax base to meet your required local contribution. Think about and maybe work toward a ballot design rule so that you can, again, address that potential for voter fatigue. So could you bundle related exemptions so that it's not for every single property, but it could be a group or category of properties or similarly related exemptions? And finally, make sure, I think, as part of this discussion, that you can protect your service areas so that for service area-specific exemptions, it doesn't undermine your ability to deliver the services that you're required to in those service areas. So those are some broad and also specific comments that I think and I hope will be constructive to further conversations about this legislation. I think the bill sponsor is spot on when it comes to we don't have to micromanage what's occurring at the local level. If we can empower local governments to enhance some of their own decision-making related to exemptions, they'll find the right mix. They'll find the right dollar amount. They'll find the right percentage of total assessed value. They have just as much interest in making sure this works for their community as you do for the state. And so this is, I think, a really good start to a very strong piece of legislation that could have meaningful impact for years to come. Thank you.
Thank you. Let's see if there's any burning questions. We're running against the clock, but I do just want to say this is the opening part of this conversation. Representative Colom and I talked that this is going to take some time. This is not a bill that's going to go through this session, but we do have more space for this discussion in the next couple of months. And I believe, Representative Colom, you'd also talked to a couple of mayors that we might potentially have her invited testimony and some other folks as well. My co-chair has a burning question.
It is a burning question. Thank you. Through the chair, to Mr. Andreasen, I represent islanded communities. You can't drive to the next town over for whatever thing it is you enjoy. So we have perhaps the highest in the nation per capita number of nonprofits in our community. Does anything in this bill, like those nonprofits are not paying property tax, is that a local decision? And does this bill have anything to do with tax exemption on nonprofits? If they have a physical base. Some of our nonprofits are, you know, someone's living room, but.
Co-chair Hemshoot. Through the chair, co-chair Hemshoot. I think so. Nonprofit exemptions are constitutional and mandatory, so they fall outside of this part of statute specifically. There also there's a lot of room within the optional exemptions, especially through like the economic development, for local governments to add to the exemptions that are out there for nonprofits. So there's already a lot of flexibility. And I know we wrestle with nonprofit exemptions in some cases, and that's a separate piece of work under mandatory exemptions. But nothing in here would necessarily harm nonprofits.
Quick follow-up.
Co-chair Hemshoot.
Thank you. Through the co-chair. So if you wanted to have an economic opportunity zone and you were going to say no property tax on your new business for a year, would that be impacted by this bill? That would be helped by this bill, I would think.
Co-chair Hemshoot, yes, that would be helped by this bill. It would allow you to develop something like that and put in place, you'd be able to define what that class of exemption looks like, who it applies to, and to what extent.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Andreasen, and I'm sure that we'll have to have you back and explain some more of those technical things to us as we move forward. I appreciate your time today. Representative Colomb, do you have anything to conclude with today?
Yeah, thank you, Co-Chair Mears. I wanted to kind of point out that I didn't really address that voter requirement. So on the bottom of page 2, that right now, if you want to exempt over $75,000, it has to go to the people to vote on it because it affects everybody. And so we kept that in because I wanted a conversation with people. Do you want to keep that in? Do you want to take it out? That's what Nils was addressing, that, you know, you could make it higher, lower. You could just say forget it and let them do it. And let municipalities do it. There is a good reason on both sides. You know, some people say the people should be able to vote on that, and some people say just the state should stay out of it. So that was something that I did look forward to a discussion on whether the committee would want to get rid of that or change it or do some of the adaptations that Nils was talking about. But I appreciate the time, and I know you guys are rushed, but looking forward to working on the bill.
Colomb, just today. We'll more time in the future for it. And I appreciate you taking this on. This is not a small bill and a small task. Mm-hmm. But it will forestall some of the work like Representative Elam presented to us last week about having to come through the legislative process or raising a dollar amount at the request of a community. Some of these things only happen when there's a champion willing to follow something through a process. So, thank you very much. Thanks. With that, we will put the bill aside. And that concludes our business for today. Stick around for the FinSub. Just a reminder that the amendment deadline for House Bill 329 is Monday, March 2nd at noon. We will be canceling the placeholder Standing Community and Regional Affairs Committee scheduled for Thursday, but we will be here for the DPS and DOC Finance subcommittees. Seeing no further business before the committee, this meeting is adjourned at 9 a.m.